From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
There was some pushback at the United Nations Tuesday over President Trump's plans to try to deconflict the situation in Afghanistan with the promise of ending the longest war in America's history. That pushback came from a familiar source.
It's a great privilege for me to be back here at the United Nations.
That was the failed 2016 Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking at the UN on Tuesday at a briefing held for the so-called Group of Friends of Women in Afghanistan, a group of primarily U.S. allies and NATO members that was assembled at the end of last year to critique any movement towards peace in Afghanistan. Clinton spoke for about 16 minutes, and we bring you these excerpts.
I agree with the ambassador, with the First Lady. There is understandably a deep hunger to end the long war in Afghanistan. Over the last 18 years, the international community has invested in assistance to help Afghanistan build their political, social, and economic institutions. American soldiers, the Allied soldiers, Afghans all, have risked their lives and safety. And Afghans from every walk of life have made it clear they want peace and they want an end to violence and casualties. Yet it is difficult to have an agreement when you leave out the government of the country that you are expecting to uphold and live under that agreement. And it's difficult to sustain an agreement if you leave out half the population in forging it. UN Secretary General Guterres recently gave a speech on women and power that is a must-read. In it, he said, trillions of dollars are spent every year on peace and security, but we should be asking whose peace, whose security? As First Lady, as Senator, as Secretary of State, I spoke out about the horrors the Taliban perpetrated against Afghan women and girls when they were in power. In fact, I was just reminded by Ambassador Revere, who was my chief of staff in the White House, that I actually received a letter from the Taliban in the late 90s telling me that I was absolutely wrong about everything that was happening in Afghanistan, and I should definitely come and see for myself. Well, I came after they were gone, not while they were there. And it is clear that Afghan women today are rightly afraid. Afraid, not just for their rights and the Constitution that was written to protect them, but literally afraid that the gains they have made with all of our help will be washed away in a rush to achieve a peace that will not hold anyway. This is not just morally wrong. This is dangerous. Dangerous to every country represented here. We must not allow a reign of terror against women and girls. The women of Afghanistan have come too far to be excluded from the negotiating table while their rights are being stripped away. But it also is true we cannot allow that to happen to Afghan women and girls because there is a direct correlation with what will happen in the country and the region and indeed the world because of that. Going forward, there are four things that need to happen. First, we should all agree that the Afghan government must be brought into the discussion. We all must remain diplomatically engaged and committed to pushing forward an inclusive intra-Afghan process, one that allows not only the Afghan government, but the Afghan civil society that has been created against such odds over the last years to be represented at the peace table. We need to enable communication to the negotiators from the broader society whose lives and futures are at stake. Look, I know how difficult this has been. From the very beginning, the Taliban said they would not talk to the Afghan government. But we must simply not accede to those wishes, leaving the Afghan government on the hook. Second, troop withdrawals must be conditioned on the Taliban keeping their word. The troops on the ground remain an important lever to persuade the Taliban to end the violence. Our goal has long been to ensure that the Taliban would cease hostilities and violence, agree to abide by the Afghan constitution and the laws that have been enacted by the Parliament of Afghanistan. The Taliban must prove that they understand and respect the significant changes that have occurred in Afghan society and demonstrate that they are willing to abide by the Constitution and give up violence and go forward in a peaceful political process. Third, our long-term engagement with Afghanistan should not be measured by troop presence alone. We cannot forget the entire country simply because the conflict has ended. We made that mistake before. Let's make a commitment that we will bring to bear all elements of civilian power, development, diplomacy, democracy, to help the Afghan people to pursue the better future they deserve. Fourth, women must be included and women's rights respected as part of any peace negotiation in Afghanistan. Women are essential to combating corruption, building economic growth, and ensuring the longevity of any agreement that is reached. If women are sidelined, the prospects for sustainable peace are slim. If society is torn apart and women pushed to the margins, it is more likely that terrorists will find a haven. There can be no sustainable peace without women's participation and rights. Over the last year, women have mobilized to ensure that their rights are not negotiated away. And according to the best surveys we have access to, the majority of Afghans stand with their women and their desire to have their rights respected. 65% of Afghan citizens say they are not willing to abandon women's education or their right to work outside the home. Let's remember, under the Taliban's rule, women and girls in Afghanistan were prohibited not only from going to school, not only from working outside the home, but from going outside the home without a male guardian, even if it was their young child who happened to be a son. And look at where we are today. More than 3.5 million girls are in school. 100,000 women are enrolled in college. Afghan women have held important positions and do so today within the government. They are members of parliament, ministers, and judges. And if you have not had the opportunity to meet those with whom I am sitting or others, please take that opportunity. Hear from them directly about what is at stake in these negotiations. The women of Afghanistan have made profound contributions to their country in reconstruction and development. They've used their voices and influence to support a moderate Afghanistan, to serve as a bulwark against the return to extremism. They've come too far, they've worked too hard, they have sacrificed too much to be excluded from the negotiating table while their rights are stripped away. And let's not look at this just in isolation. These are perilous times for our world. Nationalism, tribalism, authoritarianism are on the rise. Technology is proving to be a double-edged sword, capable of carrying open minds and democratic values to oppressed people, but also giving authoritarians the tools they seek to tighten control. And we're in the midst of a global refugee crisis that is accelerated by the climate crisis, economic injustice, and violent extremism. And in the midst of all this tumult, there are so many women across the world who are proving to be beacons of hope, doing the hard, essential work of attempting to obtain and even reinvigorating democracies. They are standing up to human rights abuses. They are exposing corruption. They are speaking the truth to power. They are taking on incredible challenges, often in the face of the cruelest, most violent resistance imaginable. I've said for a long time, and I believe more fiercely than ever today, that global progress depends on the progress of women and girls, whether it's ending a conflict, growing an economy, rebuilding a society. No country ever could, but today, no country must ever exclude half its population. Valerie Hudson, a professor at Texas A&M University, recently summed it up in a recent New York Times op-ed that I recommend to you. What you do to your women, you do to your nation. So let me say this to the women of Afghanistan, and particularly to the young women and the girls, many of whom I've had the great delight of meeting over the years. No matter what happens, know that you have friends and supporters around the world who will stand with you, who will speak out for you, who will be there during the hard times. We will not forget what you have sacrificed over all this time. We will not avert our gaze, and we will not be silent. There is no going back, no matter how much some would hope there could be. So we will keep going together. Through war or peace, tyranny or freedom, we will keep going. And I'm very grateful that once again, the UN is shining this spotlight on this critical nation and the people who deserve to have the future they have fought for and that we have supported thus far. So here's to all the work ahead, Ambassador. Thank you.
Also on Tuesday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin made a presentation to his country's parliament recommending some changes in the structures of government there, including one that would allow him to stand for yet one more term as president. We bring you as much of that presentation to the Duma on Tuesday by President Putin as time allows.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Your audience, your deputies of the State Duma, the chairman of the parliament has informed me about the discussion that was going here while considering the amendments to the Constitution to the Russian Federation and the second reading, keeping in mind the character of the conversation and that it was my initiative that started the wide discussion of possible amendments to the main law of the country. I thought it was necessary, without further ado, to talk about my position regarding the vital suggestions that have been voiced, and I told the Mr. Chairman about it. But I would like to start with the words of gratitude to the participants, to the members of the working group, to the deputies and members of the Federal Council who worked hard and participated in the preparation of the amendments to the Constitution. Once again, I would like to repeat myself, these amendments, it's been for some quite time that we needed some amendments, and they are going to be useful for the society and for the people of our country, because these amendments are directed on strengthening our sovereignty, our traditions, and our values, something that is a foundation of our life, and to expand and to make more clear social guarantees for our citizens, and to make it clear that our state has a social character, and to create conditions for confident evolutionary development of Russia in long term. I should agree with the people who spoke here. The world is changing, and it concerns not only the explosive development of technology, but all the aspects of life. And these changes, they have drastic character, and there is no way back. We see how difficult the situation is in the world politics, in the safety, in the global economy. Now we have this coronavirus to deal with, and the oil prices are jumping up and down, and the currency rate too, and the stock exchange rates too. And I would like to use this chance to say that I'm completely confident that we are going to muscle through it with dignity, and the economy by and large will become stronger, and the most important industrial areas are going to become stronger and more competitive. But we need to work, and we need to work together, jointly. But of course, it all creates additional risks, and as they say now, challenges. And of course, we are keep on saying about this. There are those in the world who would like to suppress Russia, and they are ready to use any opportunity to do this. And this suppression policy, it is being used, and we are well aware of this. And those who do this, they talk about it openly. They're waiting for our errors, our slip-ups, that we're gonna lose our bearings, or which is worse, we will become stuck in some internal struggles that are even sometimes financed from outside, funded from outside. We can even calculate how much resources are allocated to this. I know that estimations of the leading political forces regarding all these issues are similar. And during our recent meeting with the leaders of the factions in the Kremlin, that started on the 5th, and as Mr. Zyuganov noticed when he watched at the clock and he saw that the meeting was over already at night, 6th, and everyone is perfectly aware that inside the country we've got a lot, as people say,
и пока еще очень много уязвимого у нас с вами.
We've got too many vulnerabilities regarding our stability and regarding the confessional issues, economical and social development. So it's obvious why while working on these amendments, the discussions are more intensive and more active, how the higher institution of the state authority is going to be formed, presidential authority, because president is a guarantor of the constitution, guarantor of the safety of our country, of its internal stability and its internal, I would like to repeat myself, evolutionary development. Evolutionary development, I would like to emphasize this, because Russia had enough revolution in its history, so we are done with revolutions in Russia. And during my travels, visits around the country, I noticed that the people are concerned with these issues, same as you are. And I understand their concerns. I'm confident that there will be time when the higher presidential authority is not going to be so personified. It's not going to be connected with one particular person. But all our previous history was developing like that. And of course, we should remember that. And I understand my personal responsibility regarding that. I can see that the majority of people are expecting, and my personal estimations and decisions regarding the key issues of the presidential authority, both now and after, in the future. So I would like to phrase it as clear as possible, as honest as possible, as sincere as possible, and also regarding the particular suggestions that were voiced today and that were raised during the discussions regarding the amendments. So regarding Mr. Karelin's position about the necessity of new snap elections for the State Duma, my point of view here is clear. If people, Russian citizens, are going to vote for the amendments, are going to support the amendments, including the handing over part of the authority to the Federation Council. So such changes should come in power right after the vote, and the State Duma should have more authority, bigger authority immediately. Of course, there is the question if the current members of the State Duma can adopt this new authority. I'm sure that they can. Why not? All the legitimate reasons are there, of course. In the end, it is up to you. It is your decision. But if regarding this issue there is no consensus in the parliament, and from what I heard from the chairman, there is no consensus, I don't see any need for the snap elections, premature elections for the State Duma. I would like to say it one more time. If people are going to come to vote to the poll stations on 22nd of April and they are going to vote, then they will confirm the authority of the parliament. The people, the only source of power, are going to speak, and then all the discussions will be over. I would like to repeat, we are talking about expansion of the authority of the parliament, and that's a path of closer work between the two branches of power. That's how I planned it initially. It is going to mean that they will have a more mutual responsibility for the results achieved or for the lack thereof. I think that currently, at this stage of our development, of our society development, such amendments are justified because it's a quality step forward as concerning the development of our democracy. I would like to go back to the topic I've spoken about in the beginning. We've reached a certain line, and to step over it, we need to make a decision regarding a sensitive issue about the highest power, about the presidential power, and I'm convinced that strong presidential vertical for our country, for Russia, is a must. And situation today in the economy, something that I've talked about not only in economy but in the safety, with the safety issues too, just reminds us once again about this. First of all, we need it for stability. Of course, there are alternatives, and we are well aware of that parliamentary type of government that is widely used in the world. However, at this stage of our development, we can't really use it. Just look at the countries with traditional parliamentary democracy. Look at what's going on there. I'm not exaggerating. For years, some of these countries, they can't form a government. We can't have it in Russia. It is unacceptable for Russia. And say, giving other centers of power, such as Security Council or the State Council, that are not elected by people, giving them some authority, some large authority, I think it would be wrong, and it would be dangerous even. It has nothing to do with democracy, first of all, and secondly, it's going to cause a split in society. I'm sure that Mr. Zhirinovsky, who suggested that, will agree that he is an experienced politician, and for Russia, it will lead to split in the society, to two centers of power, to diarchy, and it will have tragic impact on the destiny of the country and on the destinies of its people. There were some ideas, some suggestions to introduce changes to the Constitution and to extend the presidential term of the current president. And if people are going to vote for these amendments. Yes, in April there is going to be an all-Russian vote, but in this case, the authority of the president will be extended because of the due to the elections with no alternative, and I think we shouldn't do this. Citizens of Russia at any elections of any kind, they always should have more options, more alternatives at any elections. Elections must be open. Elections must be competitive. The suggestion that was suggested by Ms. Valentina Tereshkova. We all have immense respect to her. I would like to congratulate her once again on her recent birthday. In principle, it is understandable, first, to exclude the amount of terms that the president could be elected for. The idea like this was voiced at my recent meeting with citizens, with people in St. Petersburg. One of the veterans suggested exactly that. I said that I wouldn't want to go back to the Soviet Union times. Of course, it was probably not the appropriate thing to say, because during the Soviet times we had no elections. Everything was decided behind the closed doors or inside the party procedures or intrigues. We have a completely different situation now. Now you have to go to elections. It's a different story. Formally, technically, we could have lifted the restrictions regarding the terms, and many other countries, including the neighboring countries, they have such provisions. There are no restrictions for the number of terms that the president could be elected for. And across the ocean, in the United States, the amendment to the Constitution that restricts the number of terms with two terms, it was only introduced in 1947, and only in 1951 it was voted, it was ratified by all the states. 1951, it's not that long ago. From the historical perspective, it was just basically yesterday. And I will explain. And there are precedents of having more than two terms also in the United States. Why was that? Great Depression, huge economical problems, poverty, unemployment back then. Then World War II. And under such condition, when the country is going through such problems, such difficulties, and in our case, we haven't overcome everything after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Stability may be something more important, and it must be prioritized, especially when the country is still facing a lot of problems. But when political, economical, social areas, they help to create stability, when the state is mature enough, when it's not vulnerable for the outside parties, then, of course, the change of power is necessary for the dynamics of the country's development. And we are not adopting these amendments for a year, not for 2 years, not even for 10 years. I hope we're talking about the long term, about 30, 50 years at least. And this long term perspective, the society should have guarantees that the regular alternating accessions to power will be provided. We need to think about future generations, because I think it doesn't make sense to leave the number of terms from the Constitution, to leave this restriction from the Constitution. Second suggestion actually means to leave any restrictions for any citizen, including the current president, and to allow to participate in the elections in the future, of course, in open elections, free elections, only if citizens are going to support such amendments, if they're going to say yes during the all-Russian vote on 22nd April of this year. In principle, this option could be viable, but only on one condition, namely, if the Constitutionary Court of the Russian Federation will deem that such amendment is not going to contradict the principles and main provisions of the main law of the Constitution. So let's not forget that we are not adopting a new constitution, we are introducing significant, but these are just amendments, and I would like to emphasize that changing that Constitution itself, that still has potential, that proved itself efficient, I think it shouldn't be done.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.